Hello, everybody. Welcome. Welcome, welcome. I am overjoyed to be able to meet with you like this. I realized, I think the last time we met, I said something about the fact that these meetings are like public meetings here in the non-virtual world, in that I don't know how familiar anybody who comes to them is with with what it is that I'm about and what my work is. So that, like public meetings here, I felt that I had to, every time we got together like this, I had to give you a little outline of what it is I'm about, and lest somebody just stumbled in off the street. But I realized today that in order to get here, in order to be in this in this venue, you had to go to an awful lot of trouble and spent quite a bit of time on our website. So I think it's safe to say that anybody who's in this room probably has at least a nodding acquaintance with me and my work. So I'm going to dispense with the effort to say it again one more time, what it is that I'm trying to do. Although I suspect that that's what I'm going to do anyway. But it's not because, it's no longer because I think that you don't know what I'm talking about or don't know what my work is. It's more along the lines that my work is so simple and so small that there's not much else for me to talk about except that. But I want you to know that I'm grateful for the effort you take to master this kind of unstable technology and meet with us here, all of us here. So welcome. I'm very happy to be here with you. I spent some time the other day with a woman who has known me for some years, actually, and certainly has a good acquaintance with what it is that I am saying and what it is that I am trying to do in this work, in this life. And in the course of our conversation, she said something to me that really took me by surprise. She said to me, in preparation for talking about some other, talking about Christianity, she said to me, "I know you follow Ramana Maharshi." And of course, that's absurd. The truth is that I don't follow Ramana Maharshi. The truth is that Ramana Maharshi really gave no one any encouragement whatsoever to follow him in any way or manner whatsoever, except to instruct us consistently and again to find out for ourselves what's real, what's here, what we are. And the encouragement that he provided by his own example and by his own experience, that the effort to find out for ourselves what's real, what's here, what we are, would give us everything we have ever wanted. But he had no disciples. He had disciples. He actually had no disciples exactly. He had devotees. So far as I know, in all of the time that I have spent reading Ramana and thinking about Ramana and looking at Ramana and so forth, as far as I know, he never, ever told anybody to go out and teach in his name or his teaching. Nor did he ever suggest that he was part of or the beginning of any lineage. You see, it's the whole essence of Ramana's offering the whole of it, the whole essence of Ramana's offering, is that there's only one thing worth doing in life, really. There's only one thing that has to be done in order that life can be perceived as the wonder and the gift that it is, and that is to cut through all of the conditioning and the mental chatter and the mind's insanity, and look with all your heart, trying only to see yourself. Just that, just to catch a glimpse of yourself. And Ramana told us that that was all that was needed. Well, Ramana, of course, like anybody else, like me and you, and the Buddha and Jesus Christ and everybody else, Ramana, of course, had a context which constrained him in the way that he could understand or communicate the what he wanted to understand and communicate. And the things that constrained him are his history, his culture, his upbringing, his the things he reads, the things he eats, the people he is around and associates with. So a lot of what Ramana talked about was not teaching or transmission or anything like that. A lot of what Ramana talked about, in my estimation, were the things that so delightful, the things about the ancient and the ancient spiritual utterances that so delightfully and unexpectedly resonated with his own experience in the discovery that all that's needed is to see yourself. So that he talked about a lot of teachings and he wrote a lot of poetry and he said a lot of things, none of which were teachings. They were just a to me, delightful play in this realm of spiritual utterance, recognizing its absolute poverty and inability to convey anything of any consequence, and recognizing also its delightfulness of the outcome of the effort to do so, no matter how limited. The only thing that Ramana taught, the only thing that Ramana asked us to incorporate into our own lives and minds and hearts is the suggestion that what we really want is to see ourselves and know what we are seeing. That's it. Not that we should and our resistances or become more generous or become more loving or become more empty or become sweeter or become more accepting, become less aggressive. Not any of that. That may or may not be outcomes or consequences of what Ramana suggests that we do, but he didn't ask us to do any of that. He didn't ask us to abandon our religions. He didn't ask us to abandon our spiritual practices. He didn't ask us to gain a full and clear understanding of the nature of reality and existence and manifestation. He didn't ask us to become learned and well-spoken in the ancient spiritual texts. All that was delightful play, it seems to me. He asked us to recognize that what we want, always want, above all things else, is to see ourselves and know what we're seeing. Now, I don't think, in fact, that Ramana was fully interested in some of the implications and ramifications of this suggestion. I think that Ramana, it's my feeling about Ramana, that Ramana felt that if we would undertake this on our own, that we'd find out for ourselves, and that we'd find out for ourselves what we are, and we'd find out for ourselves what the consequences of being that are, of seeing that, rather, are. He just told us to do this, to try with all our hearts to see ourselves directly, before understanding, before naming, before description, before relationship, before everything, just to see ourselves, just directly, nakedly, and see what happens as a result of that. Now, it's obvious to me that the seeing of the reality of what I am has, over time, disintegrated and destroyed a previously unsuspected conviction that I am trapped in this body, trapped in this mind, trapped in this life, constrained by its limitations, unable to fully enjoy and realize its wonder and magnificence. In my experience, in my life, just following the simple instruction of Ramana to try with all my heart to see what I am has had the effect of destroying this underlying belief that I didn't even know was here. And has revealed to me the magnificence of human life, the magnificence of existence, the glory of it, really, the wonder of it. It's passing. It's coming and going. It's craziness. All of that. So there is no Ramana Maharshi lineage of which I'm a part. There is no lineage of all of which I am a part, except the lineage of humanity, because here I am, a human being. And the lineage of humanity is this what seems on the surface to be utterly insane madness and repetitious mistakes and the endless again and again indulging in murder and warfare and hatred and rape and all of that, despite the experience we have of thousands and thousands of years of the same thing. That's the lineage I belong to. The lineage of humanity. The lineage of humanity in which we have also for thousands and thousands of years felt and responded to this deep, deep, deep call to see the truth. And we have tried everything to answer that call, to be true to that call, to follow that call. And it's manifest in religions and more hatred and more insanity and more stupidity. But here and there, every once in a while, here and there, it has resulted in ions of peace and hope, clarity. But mostly not. Mostly our deepest yearnings we have perverted and used as a engine and the energy for following the conviction that I have to do something. I've got to do something because I'm at stake here. I'm trapped in this body. I'm trapped in this life. I have to do something. I have to get something. I have to rid myself of the horror of being trapped in this life, trapped in this body, trapped in this mind, unable to make it do what I want, unable to make it think what I want, unable to make it become what I want it to become. And for thousands and thousands of years, really, the idea has been alive within the human mind that the basic problem that confronts us is a false belief about what we are, a misidentification with something in our lives, so something in our minds, something in our bodies, something that we are not who we think ourselves to be. We are not what we believe we are. And many practices and regimens and sermons and so forth have been fielded in an attempt to destroy this misidentification. We have done deep meditation practices and pranayama practices and yogic practices of all sorts, seeking to get this that we know is true, this reality that we want to be, rather than the limitation and the horror that we believe ourselves to be. And nothing works. None of it. None of those practices. They don't work. Oh, we probably do get better. But they don't work at destroying it, eliminating it, making vanish that underlying rumble of anxiety and fearfulness. And the reason they don't work, and this is where Rama's insight is heroic and radical and unexpected. The reason they don't work is because they're trying to do the wrong thing. They are trying directly to destroy something that we believe ourselves to be falsely identified with, using the very thing that we believe ourselves to be, that we falsely believe ourselves to be ourselves, to do that destruction. The mind, the life, the body, consciousness. What Ramana saw, and I don't know how explicitly he saw it, but what Ramana saw clearly was that if the problem is a lie, the only possible solution is the truth. Only the truth will destroy the lie. And that's you, the truth. You are the reality. You are the truth of it. So Ramana took up an ancient, again, an ancient practice that had become rigidified and brittle. Practice of Atmavichara, that in the past was a practice that was designed to wipe away the clouds and the dirt of the corruption of the mind in order that the true self could be seen and gone to. But Ramana turned all that on its head, and he offered us an Atmavichara that instead of asking us to go to where we are not, asked us instead to look at what we are, which is real, and that seeing itself brings in the light of truth to this life, to this mind. And the false belief that I am this body, this mind, this life, cannot withstand the light of truth over time. Somebody called that self-inquiry, Atmavichara. Probably one of the British Empire guys back in the day when they were flocking to India, and that's, you know, inquiry. Sounds like something you do with Scotland Yard. Really, what we're talking about is self-seeing. Just that. There's no like the process of testing and evaluating and analyzing experience and so forth that could reasonably be called an inquiry. There's just this seeing of what you are seeing, this direct, unmediated seeing of the background presence that you are, the experience of being that you are, that has no characteristics, that has no coming and going, no color, no means by which I can describe it, no need for anybody to describe it, since what it is you, and you're here. So, this is what I have to offer, is the encouragement and the plea and the determination to persuade you to try this anytime you can. Anytime you get a chance to do so, anytime it occurs to you to do so, just for 1 second, see if you cannot see with your mind's eye, this certainty of being that is ever-present, that never changes. See if it's true that it never changes. Just as often as you can, whenever it occurs to you, stop for a second and see what it feels like to be with your mind's eye. Just that. If you will do this for some time, it's not like a magic bullet. There are no magic bullets. We've tried magic bullets. They don't work. We've tried not-so-magic bullets, and they don't work either. The underlying structure of the personality, the underlying structure of the life, is founded on the certainty that I am this life. It is. For some, it takes a long time for that to go away. Years, 2-3 years maybe. For others, it seems to happen very quickly. But for all who will just do this, who will just let the light of reality into their minds by seeing themselves consciously, seeing themselves and knowing what they're seeing, as often as they can, without regard to anything else you're doing, meditation practice, religious practice, money-making practice, any of those things. Those are all beside the point. Anyone who will just, without regard to any of that, just stop as often as it occurs to them to do so and just get the direct seeing of this background reality. Just for a second. As often as possible. Will absolutely find over time that this underlying current of anxiety and fearfulness fades away, and that the separation, this is paradoxical, but the separation from your life that results from the belief that you are your life, because if you are your life, you better keep all of this at arm's length so you can keep an eye on it. That sense of separation that arises from this belief that I am at stake here, that too vanishes. but life reveals itself to be what it's always been. The actual, just as it is, the totality of it, the actual realization of reality. Now, there's no need to connect any of this with any spiritual utterance. The spiritual utterances, they arise spontaneously just as everything else arises spontaneously. There's no need to keep from comparing this to any other spiritual utterance either. There's no need to do anything but just see yourself now, in this moment. And watch what happens. Find out for yourself. There's no lineage here, except the lineage of humanity. Okay. I have a couple of emails that I received since the last meeting asking me to speak about a couple of things in this meeting. So that's what I'm going to do now. Someone writes to me and says, surely nothing is always here. There is undeniable beingness whenever thoughts stop and awareness of I-ness or things at other times, but sometimes there is only evidence of existence in later memory, e.g. after a stream of thoughts or a period of deep sleep, but this nothing is not perceived. Well, you know, here's the thing. If it is true that you are always here, as I say, if that's true, that you're never absent, and that's the only thing that sets you apart from everything else. If that's true, that there is indeed something that is always here, then I promise you from the bottom of my heart that this investigation, this effort to see yourself, will reveal that to you, or reveal to you the opposite. In any case, I would want to know. But I'd like you to consider this, and that is that you say sometimes there is only evidence of existence in later memory, e.g. after a stream of thoughts or a period of deep sleep, but this nothing is not perceived. I say that it is. And I say that the stream of thoughts that holds our attention, and obviously, because we're so spiritual, we get the idea that that's a problem. But the stream of thoughts that holds our attention is more colorful and moves where you don't. You don't have color. You don't move. Reality is the most ordinary thing there is. It is, that's the reason why it is pretty much invisible. If, however, every time you stop and look, you find that there is this, at that moment, unmoving, unchanging presence that has never changed any time you've looked at it, whether it's intermittently or not. If it was the same last week when you looked at it, and all the drama that occurred between now and last week, when it held your attention for all that time, when you look at it again now, it is the same as it was last week, unaffected, unhurt, unhelped by any of that drama, then it's reasonable for you to conclude within the constraints and limitations of human intellect that it was there all along. This is something that in what world am I talking about? In the world of everyday life is called the permanence of objects. And it is something that a baby has to learn, that when an object disappears behind something and it comes out again on the other side, that it's the same object that it was when it disappeared behind it, that it didn't just vanish and then reappear. It's the same with this reality. It is the same principle as the permanence of objects. If you look at it now, and it's the same as it has been every time you looked at it, then it's reasonable to conclude, even within the constraints of the human mind, that it's always been there, unchanged and unchanging. But even that's beside the point. I tell you that it's unchanged and unchanging in order to give you some hint as to what it is you're looking for. You're looking for that which is always the same every time you look at it. That's you. That's you. It is the looking, the seeing, that does the work. Not the conviction that it's always there, that it's permanent, that it doesn't change. That's beside the point. That's a conclusion that you can reach reasonably in the mind. But that's beside the point. The only reason I speak about these things is because I know from my own experience that this reality that I am asking you to see, if you look at it now, it'll be the same as when you looked at it 5 minutes or 5 years ago. And that's a hint as to how, as to what it is I'm asking you to see. But it's there. It's the permanence of objects. I have another email from England which asks me, okay. He says this, the question has to be as kind of a report. As often as I can, I have been looking at, feeling, experiencing, words are hard to express this, the fact that I am here. I have ideas about other people out there, including you, but really, the only person or being, the only experience that I can have is what I experience, and that is always here. Although my mind covers this simple reality like a cloud often. I'm already getting confused. Please, could you speak more about what it feels like to experience one's self? Actually, the truth is that what it feels like to experience yourself is exactly how you feel right now, always. Whether it's not that the activities of the mind can cover or obscure or deny you the experience of seeing what you are, it is that because the movement of mind and thought and so forth is so colorful and so interesting and entertaining, we have a habitual, and there are other things linked to this too, having to do with the fact that we believe that we're at stake here. But it has this habitual attraction to us, so that we would rather look at the swirls and colorful movements and interesting convolutions of ideas and understandings and so forth, then look at this reality that, after all, never changes. It's ordinary. It's always here. And you are always seeing it. There is never a moment that you are not seeing it. You're just not attending to it. So the experience of oneself is the experience that you always have. It may not be the experience that you're attending to, although that too, really, in a sense. But it's always here, and you're always seeing it. There's never a nanosecond when you're not seeing it. In fact, the whole spiritual game turns out to be an effort desperately, a desperate effort to see what I have always already been seeing. The investigation, the repeated efforts, the repeated seeing of reality will deal with this. It's the seeing that does all the work. Again, there's no understanding that can help you. There's no clarification that can help you. There's no description that can help you. It is only the seeing that helps. It's only the seeing that does the work. The conscious seeing of truth. So, I hope that's helpful. It feels like you. That's what it feels like. Oh, and I have an email also. I'm sorry. I have an email also from someone whose email I read or referred to in January 5th online meeting, in which the person had talked about something about self-talk stopping and that being a critical turning point in my life. And I guess that I'm not sure what the question was, but what I said was I don't ever remember saying that. And then I went on to say whatever else I said. But he has written to clarify what he was talking about. And what he's talking about is the fact that I have often spoken about my first meeting with Gangaji in prison and how, as she spoke, everything stopped. The movement of the mind, the agendas, the judgments, the everything really stopped. The mind was as empty as it can be. And that how, in the absence of all of that, I remained. Well, that's true enough. But that's true for everybody. Whenever thought is absent, you remain. If the body is absent, you remain. In deep sleep, you remain. Now, and everybody has had this experience. If you have, it might not. I'm kind of a worst case here. Most people don't have all the trouble I did, but getting over this madness of belief. But everybody has the experience many times, although it may go unnoticed or unremarked or unremembered. But everybody has the experience all the time of mind stopping. It's always starting and stopping. It rises, it ramifies, it creates this huge efflorescence, and then it sinks, and then it rises again. And even in the current iteration of the mind, between every thought there is nothing. Everything stopped. Nothing. And we don't notice that. But that's the truth. In deep sleep, there's nothing. And we don't notice that, but that's the truth. You are there. I am there. So that the key is not the experience of everything stopping. That's not the key. The key is not the experience of empty, clear, open mind. That's not the key. That's always here. Always accessible. That's you, in fact. The key is recognizing it as yourself. That emptiness, that clarity, that calmness. That is always revealed whenever thought departs. Practicality of self-inquiry or self-seeing as a practice, the practicality of it is that in the seeing of yourself, what you see is precisely this vast, unmoving, truth of the matter. And you know that it's you. And if you don't quite know that it's you, you know that it's here when everything else is gone. So, for all of my life, I had experiences just like everybody else of mind gone, thought stopped. And probably if I thought about it at all, I thought that it was a problem and I had to rush to fill that void with thought, lest it swallow me, I guess. But all my life I had those experiences, and all your life you've had those experiences from time to time of mind stopping, of nothing there but this. If only someone had been there to say to you, that's you. You are what remains. Look there whenever you can. Surely by now, the infatuation with the idea that I am at stake in this life would have vanished. If only someone had been there to say that to you. But I'm here now to say that to you. Whenever your mind stops, look at it. See what remains. See. You don't have to know what it is. Just see it. It's the seeing that does the work. So whenever mind stops, whenever you find an absence of thought and activity, see what remains. Allow its light to enter you. See it. And now that you know, you also know that you can do this deliberately with the intention of seeing what's here, what underlies it all. And that deliberate enactment of this practice will over time, I promise you from my heart, will over time wipe away all of the background of cause for fearfulness and anxiety. It's not the episodic disappearance of thought that is of any use to us. Unless we see it, see what remains when thought goes. It's not the absence of thought. Thought's welcome here. I am here. Always, I am here. And every human being, every cat and dog, every snail and slug, every rock and mountain can say the same thing. I am here. Thought or no thought, I am here. Drama or no drama, I am here. See it. Just look at it. See it. So, okay, is there anyone now who would like to speak with me? I would love to speak with you.
We have Earl. He's calling from Barrière, I think, in British Columbia, Canada.
Earl, can you hear me? Can you speak? Well, this is what I mean when I say how grateful I am that everybody takes the effort required to get here and wrestle with this this kind of quirky technology. I don't know what to tell you because, of course, I don't know what the circumstances are where you are, but keep trying. I hope you get your microphone working. I'd love to talk with you. Anybody else?
Yes, we have John T. in England.
Hi, John.
Hello, John. Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well.
That's great. I have a question for you. I'm going to put it two different ways. How do you sleep at night? And does the practice of self-inquiry affect sleep?
the process of self-inquiry actually affects everything. And I couldn't possibly tell you, you know, exactly what effect it has had on my sleep. I can tell you that I sleep really, really well and happily, and rarely have any difficulty sleeping. Is that what you wanted to know?
In a way, yes. If I can just describe something that's been happening to me, I would say I experience sleep sort of three different ways. Sometimes it's normal sleep, as you've described, where the world disappears, and in the morning, without conscious volition, everything seems to come back. And then sometimes I have sleepless nights where I toss and turn, and I have to get up for a drink, go to the loo, and I feel pretty bad. And next day, usually, I feel terrible. But sometimes I seem to be getting a different type of not sleeping. My feeling is that I don't sleep at all night. That's my impression. I mean, it could be wrong, but that's how it feels. But I don't get up. I don't do anything. I don't feel good. I don't feel bad. I suppose I'm just lying there. And generally, with that type of not sleeping, the next morning I don't feel tired. And what I'm thinking is, I was wondering, it's like that. Does the practice of self-inquiry, after you've tried so many times, as it were, to sort of turn on the light of awareness, or at least mistakenly thinking that, is it the case that one day there's no switch, there's no off switch anymore, and you're kind of always on, as it were?
Well, I recognize the experience you're describing, and I haven't had that experience for a number of years now, so I would have to say that the time comes when that experience, like all experiences, dies a peaceful death, and sleep returns. but I do know what you're talking about, and I do think it's connected with the inquiry, and I think actually that it's a sign that the inquiry is continuing as the mind shuts down.
Okay, thank you.
Is that helpful?
Yes, it was. Yes. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Is there anybody else?
Yes, we have Chris calling from Melbourne, Australia.
Hi, John. How are you going?
Hi, Chris. I suppose it is Australia, huh?
Yeah, it is Australia. I think I tried to create a second profile and I put a 1 or something. I don't know what happened. I logged in first time, it was normal, now it's got a 1. But anyway, it's Melbourne. My first question is, what do you refer to when you talk about spiritual? Because to me, what you are talking about is ultimate spirituality.
Here's the thing, right? We are in these human forms, we are endlessly exploring and trying to understand what experiences are rising and falling within us. And that human inclination is just a human inclination. But that's what we do, and it's a game, and it can be very beautiful, it can be very horrible, it can be helpful, it can be harmful, it can take on a lot of things. But what we do as humans is try to name things and understand, and thinking that if we name it, we've got it. We understand it. It's ours. Well, it's okay to say that we're talking about an ultimate spirituality rather than a penultimate spirituality or a trivial spirituality. But really, all I'm ever talking about is you. And this is what I mean when I say that I think that most of what Ramana talked about when he talked about spiritual teachings was the delightfulness of how they actually... Oh, right. Now I see what they were saying. Now I understand what it is that gave rise to that utterance and so forth. But that's not helpful to the person who believes himself trapped in a human body, in a human mind, in a human life, to talk about this is a spiritual or ultimately spiritual, or this is emptiness, or this is sunyata, or this is anything at all except you. Because the only thing that's helpful to the one who is suffering from the belief that we are trapped in these human bodies and lives and so forth, the only thing that's helpful is the direct seeing of reality, the direct seeing of the truth of what we are. And I always kind of resist being distracted into whether this is a spiritual matter or not a spiritual matter. And I know that most of the spiritual utterance of the past has done us no good. In fact, if anything, it's kind of given us something to worry about. And truthfully, there is nothing to worry about. There really is nothing spiritual about what I am suggesting. What I am talking about is you. Just you. Just as you are. And if spiritual is a word that is useful to you in describing that, then that's fine. But reality is neither spiritual or not spiritual. Reality cannot be contained in human understanding or in human relationship. So, to me, in the period when one believes oneself to be trapped, those spiritual utterances are a burden rather than a help. After that feeling, that conviction that I'm trapped is gone, those spiritual utterances are a delightful failed attempt. And even calling things spiritual is a delightful failed attempt to say something real about reality. So, it's okay. I mean, really, it's all okay. But I don't think that what I'm talking about is spiritual. Is that helpful at all?
Yeah, it is helpful. I don't see why you need to say that it's not spiritual. I don't see that you need to say that it is spiritual either, but I don't see why you need to continue to make the point that it's not spiritual.
Well, I don't really need to continue to make that point, except for the fact that people keep coming to me with spiritual questions and spiritual ideas and references to spiritual utterance of the past. And as I said, the thing about this spiritual stuff is not that it's wrong or bad or needs to be done away with. It's just not helpful. And so I don't talk about it except to say that I don't talk about it. It's just not helpful, really.
Okay, so it's not helpful to say it is spirituality, but I would still maintain that it's not helpful to say that it's not. But anyway, that doesn't really matter. It's just a point I thought was interesting to raise with you. Second question was, everything, when you've said a few times everything, or that you see everything as you, or all I see is me, that's something which I guess I would put in that category of not knowing how anyone could possibly relate to that. Just wondering what exactly you mean by that, or you know, perhaps I don't know whether that's helpful to people, that phrase to say that everything is me. Could you elaborate a little on exactly what you mean? Because I've heard a few teachers generally talk about that, but I've really no idea what exactly they're getting at.
Okay. There's nothing I ever say, first of all, but number one, there's nothing I ever say other than look at yourself that's of any help at all. The rest of it is all play. It's all, I don't know why we speak the way we do. I don't know why these things manifest in the way they do, except that it's just play. But none of the things I say, if I say, I have never seen anything but myself, and I'm sure I have said that, that is not intended to be helpful to anybody. It's just me talking. That's all. There's nothing behind it at all. But I will say this. It is my constant experience that I have never, ever been able to find or see anything here but me. But I. That is my constant experience. And I don't know that, just as it is of not much use to say it, it's probably of even less use to try to explicate it. But where are all these others? Where do I find them? Well, I find them in my mind. That's where I find them. Where are all these things and creatures and skies and planets and people and cats and all of this? Where are they? They are, for me, they are in my mind. I cannot say with any certainty even that this human body that I seem to be speaking through actually exists. It is a conglomeration, a concoction, a thing that is put together in my mind. That's what it is. Whether it actually corresponds to something in some other world, I can't know. And having seen that and having been really clear on that, I also have seen that all of the impulses that are so filled with despair, the impulses to take from others, the impulses to kill, the impulse to harm, the impulse to hold and grasp and deny others and all of that. I also see very clearly that all those impulses are mine. Where else are they? They're mine. So that seeing all of that, I find no basis whatsoever for blaming you, for trying to fix you, for trying to make you be better and less aggressive and less angry and less or more anything. Because it's me, for God's sake. That's where it all is. I've never seen anything but me. And neither have you seen anything but you, which is the same me as my me. See why I don't like to talk about this stuff? I'm not very good at it, and I don't see that it does anything but kind of my efforts to talk about it do anything but invite confusion. Okay?
I definitely don't agree with that, John. I think you talk brilliantly and beautifully and very originally, and just the timing and the meter and the way you direct people back to looking after going through a little elaboration is very beautiful, and I think it's incredibly helpful, even though when we get into the philosophical, you know, more accurate kind of seeking for it, you know, we can say, oh, well, it's not this or not that, but no, anyway, I think you're very great and helpful and very generous to be doing this the way you are. My third question, and thank you for that, that was very nice. When you say seeing or self, all I see is me, why do you call that self? Because I guess that could be to me, I mean, you could just be referring to the ego sense of I, or the, you know, the image of me that I have, you know, as a life or, you know, past experience and all of that, and putting it together and saying, here I am, this is what I am with this body and so on, which is obviously deluded. But to call that self is what most people do, that sense of I. So to me, self-inquiry is actually looking through that or seeing that that's something that's being held in the mind and looked at by awareness itself, or, you know, you get into trouble as soon as you're looked at by anything, because ultimately any concept, as you were just kind of talking about, is erroneous, and when you investigate it, doesn't exist, and what is left, suchness is left. and that is ultimate reality or what you call self. But I'm saying, do you think that's really something that we should call self, because it might be confused with that sense of ego?
Well, you see, the reason that the sense of ego is so compelling and so seductive is because it mimics, because we are convinced that it is ourself. I think it's very useful to call it self, because that's what it is. It is the source of everything. It's not the source of everything. There is nothing but you. That's what I mean when I say that. There is nothing but you. Now, I tell you from my heart that the mind is endlessly interested in shoring up ego and getting itself together and protecting itself from errant ideas and dangerous spiritual utterances and so forth. But it cannot protect itself against this self-seeing. It can't. What I ask people to look at is precisely what they are. It is the only thing that's always here. And there can't be anything else that I am but that. Now, I guess we could quibble, and maybe in some venues and some circumstances I wouldn't use the word self. It's entirely dispensable to me. It's all beside the point, the words that are used. I am always trying only to do my best to bring people's attention, which, you know, if we start getting philosophical about this stuff, there really is a valid argument to be made that none of this is happening anyway, that the whole business of attention and attending to and looking at and moving the mind and so forth itself is all empty and lacking in any substance or meaning whatsoever. But all, nevertheless, have the continuous experience of being able to look at what they want to look at and look away from what they want to look away from. And so that's what I call upon. And everything I say has no purpose other than to bring the power of your attention, your conscious attention, to this underlying light of reality. And I don't care what we call it, really. I mean, even calling it reality is a spiritual term and cannot be contained in that. I don't care what we call it. What I know is that if you look at this permanence often enough, you will lose the idea that you are this impermanence and limitation. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. I'd just like to make one little point there. With respect to, I think it is okay personally to call it reality, that ultimate sense of being, or when things, you know, emptiness, when things have been, the false sense of things has been cleared away, or what you thought was, you've now penetrated and seen isn't, and there is just suchness. That is ultimate reality, and the reason it's called ultimate reality is because it exists in the way that it exists in the way that it appears, whereas false realities don't exist in the way they appear. So, for instance, my ego appears as me, and I think I'm this, and, you know, go around and do all these things under the guise of being that. However, when I investigate that, I see, oh no, that was all just an illusion or in a dream, and I can't find any real essence on it anywhere. So although it's okay and it functions as that on a conventional level, it functions as that me, and people can say, oh, that's him and that's someone else, and they can make that correct distinction. However, when that's investigated, it's found to be empty. And that final emptiness, or that is the ultimate reality, and that is reality simply because it appears in the way that it exists, whereas the other appears, but doesn't actually exist in that way once it's investigated.
And do these things exist in any way whatsoever? Does ego exist in any way whatsoever apart from reality? Is there anything that is separate from ultimate reality?
Yeah, I'd say that it does exist, but not ultimately. So it's like an illusion. So once it's put to the sword of investigation, it's found not to exist. However, on the conventional level, it does exist because it functions in that way. It functions as ego. And that's why I can eat, because there's food, there's me, and I can eat. And if I didn't eat, I'd die. So that's a truth, but it's an illusory truth. Because all those things, you know, what is eating, at what point are you actually eating? Is it the digestion? Is it when it goes in the mouth? Is it when the food's on the table? All those things, if you investigate them enough, you'll find that there is no such thing as eating. However, that doesn't mean you can't eat. So conventionally, yes, they are real. They're not real, but they're true on that conventional level, because they function in that way, and things function, karma functions, all those things function in that way. However, ultimately, the way they appear and the way we assume they are is false. And the only thing that appears in the way that it truly exists is that ultimate reality that you continually point to people to, which is the most helpful thing you can do for anybody, in my view.
It's the only thing I can do for anybody. I'm curious, and we're not going to take this on for too long, but I am curious as to whether the one who is doing the looking and the investigation into the reality or false reality of appearance and objects and so forth, whether that one exists or not.
That exists, and at the same time, it exists in the sense that can't function without the awareness, without the, you know, without beingness, without a person, without that ultimate ability to know, or the mind. Because what is a person is that which entails, that which has a mind, or what is a being is that which has a mind. I mean, a rock is not a being, so I wouldn't agree with you that a rock can say, I am here. Or anything can say, I'm here. It's only that which is endowed with mind that can say, I'm here. So there is here-ness with respect to that. So in that sense, there is existence. However, if the person, whilst being engaged in that activity of philosophical inquiry or whatever it is relating as the ego, thinking, I am now doing this, you know, sense of inquiry, then that doesn't exist.
Okay, I'm going to move on here, but first I want to say something, and that is that, let me think how I can say this. I would ask you to look and see whether this false reality, how it can be that a false reality is subject rather than object, first of all. And I'd like to give you an idea of the way I see these things, since I don't know any other way to do this. The problem is not some object or occurrence or mechanism within the life, like ego, for example, that flails about and looks here and there, investigates this, investigates that, and investigates reality and is somehow separate from reality and so forth. That's not the problem. I mean, that mechanism, that mechanism is fine, that there would be the feeling that I am separate from reality and that I can investigate certain arisings and phenomena and discover that they are empty of real existence and exist only conditionally and so forth. That's all fine. There's no problem with any of that. And the elimination of that won't be the elimination of any problem either, because it's not the problem. It's okay. It's fine. It's the philosophical beliefs that you espouse, they're fine too. There's nothing to be gained from trying to dissuade you or to correct you or to think that I am in a position to be able to correct you even. There's nothing to be gained from any of that. What my experience is this, is that life, the mind, the body, are composed of reality. The whole world, with all of its illusory nature, and its impermanent nature, and its conditioned nature, the existence or inexistence of conditioned nature, all of those things have as their essential element reality. There's nothing other than that, of which they can be made. The mind is not to be, is not a problem. The ego is not a problem. The body is not a problem. The perceptions, the understandings, the disputes about what's real and what's not real, not a problem. Not what I'm talking about. The problem is the conviction that underlies that entire apparatus, that this is me. This is all that I am. It's not a conviction that is defined or spoken or seeable, or it can be seen only by inference, only by the arising of the fearfulness and anxiety that connects to the events of life. That's the smell of it. It can't be seen. It's not this tendency or that tendency, this characteristic or that characteristic. It is the underlying conviction that I am this and all, and this is all I am. And whatever happens to this happens to me. And I am at stake here. And I better figure out something to do about it. And even that is not the problem. The problem is this unseeable, invisible, false belief that I am subject to all of that. And no amount of philosophical understanding, and I am no stranger to philosophy, I love it. I think it's a wondrous play to do. But no amount of philosophical understanding will disassemble that underlying deep structure of the apparatus of the life. The only thing that will do that is that it be exposed as often as possible to the clear, direct seeing of the light of reality. Whatever it's called, whether the one seeking it believes it to be separate from them or not, whether the one who is seeking it has a deep philosophical understanding or no philosophical understanding. The only thing that will destroy that, the source of all that problem, is the light of truth, is to be exposed to the light of truth again and again. Not with no understanding or naming or description even attached to it. Just like you would take medicine. Just like you would drink a glass of water. And just like drinking a glass of water hydrates the body unseen to you, so too the invitation of the light of reality into the apparatus of this life destroys the belief that you are this life. And then, whatever philosophical delights play within your mind are delights. And whatever resistance to philosophical activity may play in someone else's mind, that too is delightful. Always has been. So, I'm really grateful to you for spending this time in this conversation with me, and I hope it's been helpful to somebody. I hope it's been helpful to you. I hope it's been helpful to anybody that hears it, because this is really at the cutting edge of it. I don't care. I do not care what reality is. I don't care whether it's self or not self. I don't care about any of it. I care about all human beings taking the practical step of bringing to bear their natural intelligence to get the direct conscious seeing of reality, which I claim to be you. But what do I know? So thank you for this, Chris. I'm going to move on to somebody else now, but tell me if this was helpful to you at all.
Thanks, John. Yeah, it's very helpful, and it's a pleasure. And I say to you and to everyone else that what you are directing people to have a look at is the best thing to do, and that, you, like you say, you don't necessarily have to have any kind of understanding of it, and just, but if you can do that exercise, just do it. And you're 100% right, and thank you so much for putting it in this way that I've never heard anyone put it so simply and directly and accessibly for people. So thank you so much for all of that.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you, Chris. Who's next?
Next, we have Steve in the UK.
Steve, hello. Oh, yeah, I can hear you now. You got it fixed, huh?
Yeah, that might have been somebody else, yes. Thanks. Well, to echo the last guy's comments, I mean, thank you. You are very clear. You are pushing the point, and if anything does work, it obviously has to be the self-inquiry. But it listening to you, it's obvious there's some shift with you. Something has happened, something in that. It's not intellectual. You see yourself as being the quiet, the thing behind the eye. This obviously isn't the case for myself, and it isn't the case apparently for most people. It's something that has to happen, perhaps regardless of understanding. All I can say on the understanding level is it's easy to see on a man level how we are not our sense of identity, we are not our own man. Thoughts arise and you identify with them how you wish. But there is this body attachment that I do not see how anyone can avoid. If you are asleep and not conscious, if you are ill, if you die, if you're injured, whether you're aware of something about to happen or not, that will affect you, it will affect your thoughts, it will affect what happens next. You clearly see you are not your body, but if you like to myself, to people from the other side, I cannot avoid that conclusion.
You see, that's just the point, Steve, is that you don't need to abandon the idea that you're the body. I mean, I know that there are those who seem to be saying that, but that's not the problem. The problem isn't the idea that you're the body. The problem isn't the connection to the body. None of that's the problem. The problem is the belief that you are this life, and that's all. The belief that you are the body disappears with the belief that you are the life, but the connection to the body doesn't disappear. It doesn't disappear. And the fact that what happens affects the world doesn't disappear. That's, you know, this is what people spend a lot of time in reflection about. But there's no need for that either. All that's needed is to let the light of truth into the personality. That's all that's needed. All of that stuff is fine. You let it be. What's it to you? It doesn't hurt you. The actual fact of the matter is, and I ask you not to believe this, but to discover it for yourself as the fruit of the inquiry. But the actual fact of the matter is that nothing that happens in your life or your mind or your body helps you or hurts you in any way whatsoever. And the way you can tell that is true is the same way we were talking about before, in the looking at yourself, and the looking at what the one thing that is never absent, it's easy to see that one reality that's never absent is untouched by anything that happens in the life. So it doesn't mean that all of a sudden you're not, you know, scared of snakes or spiders or that you really would rather die than live. None of that's true. That's all speculation. What's true is that it is absolutely possible to rid yourself of all false belief by exposing yourself to the truth. And the truth is what's always here. Look at that. Look at that. Now, all the rest is beside the point. I don't know whether that's helpful or not.
I clearly hear what you're saying, and again, I understand. I just, it's whenever one thing that is never absent comes up, my mind screams at me, well, it's never absent when I'm conscious, when I'm not in severe pain, when I've not been distracted by something very sharp that's happened outside. It's never absent when I'm in certain physical conditions. At other times, it is absent, because from my perception, obviously, I am not that, though I'm very aware of that. And again, it's just tiny and yet great divide that you're talking one side of it, I'm talking the other. You say, you know, let the light of self shine, and you also say nothing that happens in the man makes a difference, and that's how I understand it. My wishing to let the light of self shine makes no difference. It will happen or it won't happen. I understand. To continue the practice, I will do so. And again, thank you very much for that. To repeat something I said before, I see nothing better. But it's just a question of time.
Steve, the truth is that all I want you to do is to continue the practice. And and you'll see. I swear to you, you'll see. But there's no need. Here's what I'm saying. There's no need to be convinced that reality is always here and unchanged. I say that only to give you an idea of what to look for. There's no need to be convinced of that. There's no need to be convinced that you are that reality that never changes. Being convinced of it is of no use to you. And the only thing that's of use to you is to look at it. That's all. And it's not that you need to look at it and have the experience of the light of truth shining in the light in the dark and everything. When you look at it, that's exactly what's happening. The light of truth is entering the apparatus of the personality, and it does the work. That's all I'm saying. There can be what seems to be excruciating difficulty with this, and it can be very painful. And I, believe me, I know about that. It can be very confusing, and it can be almost crippling in the fact that it seems not to give me anything that I want. But I tell you, from someone who has a personal experience with the difficulties of the inquiry, that if you persist, everything will turn out right. And it doesn't mean that it'll turn out with you believing yourself to be always here. It doesn't mean you turn out any way at all. Everything will turn out right. And that's all I'm saying. The rest of it, everything else I say, is just... Well, if it were more lyrical, I would say it's just singing. It's just play. It's just a way of engaging with you, of meeting you, of hearing what it is that you're saying and what it is that you're going through. All that's needed is to look. All that's needed is to look. You don't have to believe in it. You just have to look. Okay? Happy to speak with you anytime.
And your support is valued. Thank you.
We have Greg calling from Eugene, Oregon.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, John. Can you hear us all right?
Yes, I hear you very well. What can I do for you?
Really, this is just a report. First, I want to thank you for all you bring to everybody, all those here today, everybody that's ever stumbled across you on the internet or your podcasts. I'm very grateful.
You're very welcome.
I'd just like to tell you once again that since I found you and just have the intent to look for myself, most of my desires have dropped away. I get such states of peace, such states of not wanting, that I guess I really don't know what else to say on that. I really struggled at first with the first teachers of self-inquiry I stumbled across, and was fighting my mind, fighting not wanting my mind, you know, thinking that the mind had to leave so I could realize the self. And as I said, once I stumbled across you and your teaching, that everything's okay.
Thank you so much. I love to hear reports like that. Keep in touch. Let me know how you're doing over time, Greg. It's good to hear from you.
I will, John. Thanks again for being there. And I know I fire some emails off you. They help as well. Thanks again.
Earl wants to try again, calling from Barrière in British Columbia.
Earl, are you there?
Yeah, hi, John. Can you hear me now?
At last. Yes, I can.
Yeah, sorry, John. I had to reinstall the software in order for it to work properly. Good to hear you.
The same. Thank you for taking the effort to do so.
So this is my first time talking to you. I just wanted to actually just talk to you and thank you very much for everything that that you've been doing, because it truly helped me a great deal.
Oh, well, I'm so happy to hear that. It's my pleasure, believe me. Is there anything I can help you with?
Nothing specifically, John. I've been in the spiritual arena for 30 years. I practice with a guru, and I've had all kinds of wonderful experiences and states. I experienced myself as one with everything and consciousness, but the part of the problem was I wasn't getting rid of the concept of I and what that was. But now that I've been practicing your technique, it's really helped me a great deal. So I just want to thank you very much for all of the effort you're putting out there to get everybody connected to that. And that's it. And I love you very much.
Same. I'm very happy to hear that. You know, it's interesting to me that when people speak of the oneness of all being, that the one thing that's not welcome in the oneness of all being is separation. And yet, separation, the experience of you and I being separate entities, you in British Columbia and me in Ojai, speaking like this and meeting like this, that experience of separation is very welcome here. I'm very happy to have this opportunity to speak to you like this. So thank you so much, and keep in touch. Let me know how you're doing, okay? Okay, that's it. Or just about it, anyway. Carla has some things that she needs to speak with you about before you leave. Boy, I never know what to say. I'm just so grateful. I'm so happy for this life. I'm so happy to be of use to people. I'm so happy to see you here. I just can't believe my good fortune in this life. And just thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I did want to say something about my irresponsibility concerning emails. I think I make this excuse probably every time I meet with people. But I just really love getting emails from everybody. And I love reading what people have to say. And it is extremely useful to me and to those who meet with me, because it teaches me how to speak to you. You know, it teaches me how to speak to you. And I can't live without that. And I read all my emails, and I have them all organized so that they're all standing in line waiting to be replied to, and have been for some time. I don't know what to say except that I'm sorry if it takes me a long time to reply. I'm grateful that you write to me, and please keep doing so. I'm at your service. We're in this together. Thank you so much for your time and attention today. Please hang out for a minute because Carla has some things to say. I am. I'm shy.